And we're here with Judith Ferry Baker, and she brought up a topic that's always been near to my heart, the Chicago plot to assassinate JFK. I know when I first came across that, you know, I just dropped because it was never, ever talked about. And I researched it and wrote a very good blog on it. It's at my conspiracy-cafe website. And I use the word conspiracy perfectly well because the CIA told us we're going to have that word to denigrate people who do something that used to be in the 19th century called deductive reasoning. So we're going to change that word to make it conspiracy, to make it look like you're a kook because you're actually thinking for yourself and analyzing data and not taking the mind control poisons they want to give you to take off track. But a very special Secret Service agent was involved in this, Abraham Bolden. And, you know, it was just a miracle. And Lee was there, too. And, you know, Lee had a car with New York plates or something that, you know, these guys were in so that they could track and follow this group of assassins who were held by the Chicago PD intelligence unit because at that time the Secret Service didn't do what they do today. It's pre-assassination time. But the word got to JFK, and the source was named Lee. And the fact that the shooters got a car tagged to his license plate kind of narrows it down a little bit about what Lee we're talking about, that he was working as an inside agent to protect John Kennedy. And he got information to him that he didn't go to Chicago. And not going to Chicago is like a priest not going to the Vatican when he's called. That's just like Crime Central in a way for politicians, is you have to meet the local mafia in Chicago. And it's just, you know, it brings tears to your eyes that a man who's done so much is set up to be the patsy, the villain in the history that's rewritten, and so much is concealed and never revealed to keep you a prisoner of thought. And that's a terrible shame. But it's like I told you before, my grandfather said, the greatest thing that you have to do for yourself is think for yourself. Never let anyone else do your thinking for you. Look it up, research it, and then I see a great name here at the end of my blog because one of the greatest reporters who ever lived was back there, and I used to contact him all the time. I loved that man. When he died, it was, you know, just like the world lost the greatest, Sherman Skolnick. And anyone who's anybody and looking at, you know, a dogged reporter who's just like a, you know, a vicious dog going after a bone, that was him, and these people just had to shiver when he was on the loose to you know, take them into the press and just crucify them right there with the truth. An amazing man. You know, we need more like him, and hopefully a few are still around that are going to do this. Judith is one of them. As a, you know, a documentary researcher for history, living history, because she's still alive, we can talk to her. You know, we just have to be mesmerized at what happened. So let's get into Lee a little bit and tell us, you know, what happened. You know, I do know that you say he was a dead shot and he was very familiar with firearms, and you went shooting in New Orleans, that he had, you know, a pistol and you went to a place to shoot it and all this sort of thing. What were some of the things that were important about New Orleans back then?
Well, about, especially when I say about the guns, one of the things that Lee brought up, he said, what do they mean they want to invite me to be, you know, part of the ring of people who could shoot? He said, I'm not a world-class shooter. That's ridiculous, you know. He could see right through that. But there's so much that he risked. He thought it was worth the risk anyway. One of the things he said, he saw too many faces, and that meant that they were going to kill him. And yet he didn't leave. He stuck it out. And I'm alive because he did. If he had run, they would have killed all of us. That's the bottom line. When I think of New Orleans, I think of a time of tremendous romance. I fell in love with him with all my heart. He was a wonderful man, and I'm not saying he's perfect. Nobody's perfect. I haven't met Mr. Nobody yet, but I hear he's perfect. But nobody's perfect, and that's about the only one that is. What I can tell you is that Lee Oswald matured a great deal. He was only 23 when I met him, and barely 24 when he died. This is a young man who gained an aura about him of, I would say, almost of nobility. He realized he was going to die, and he was willing to stay the course anyway, because he might have a chance still of saving the president. That was the bottom line for him. He admired Kennedy so much. That's a horrible irony that the man who taught me to love Kennedy, because I had really disliked Kennedy, had been among all these anti-Castro Cubans at the University of Florida. They were my friends. We would stand up and cheer against Kennedy at football games. And so I go to New Orleans, and I run into a man who says, if you only knew what kind of man Kennedy was, you wouldn't feel like that. And he taught me. And I'm not the only one. We had the book called Marina and Lee by Priscilla McMillan, Johnson McMillan. And in there, Marina says, and this woman didn't like Lee Oswald, but even she had to write in this book that Marina was taught to adore Kennedy through her husband, Lee Oswald.
Indeed. Another factor, too, that people have to remember is they wanted him so bad. I believe there were probably up to 3 assassination teams, so that there was probably always somebody on station. So after Chicago, these guys went south, probably to Dallas, but they might not have been part of the WAC team that was used at that time. There was also one being set up in Florida because he was supposed to go to Florida. And I believe they used a lot of cover for things that were going on, like the Bay of Pigs.
They may have just been doing dry runs to see if they could get away with it, because they had such control in Texas compared to anywhere else. I mean, we're talking about a very ambitious vice president who had the choice between going to prison or becoming president. And I mean, you know, he had motivation.
Sounds like a Democratic candidate we have today. Got a choice between going to prison or being the president. But that's another story, but that's where, you know, history keeps repeating. There's a great movie out called Executive Action, done in 1973, that gets into these shooting assassination teams. And, you know, Burt Lancaster's in it. It's spectacular.
And, by the way, what's interesting about that movie is that you had Burt Lancaster and other famous people in it, and they shut it down. I mean, it was only shown in a few movie theaters. It's amazing that it still exists, and people should see it, because it's pretty good. All
it
right.
Really gets into the meat and potatoes, let me tell you.
Just to say about Lee Oswald and his ability to shoot, I mean, I from the time I was 8 years old, I was doing 2 things, building TV sets and shooting. And fishing and all that. We had a lot in common with Lee as far as all that survival instinct and all that. He wanted to go in the jungles, and I did too, and so on. But what really impressed me about his shooting and all that is he was good and short, but he didn't like rifles. He didn't care about rifles. I mean, and you can't even find any incident. You have to have a rifle to make those kind of long shots. And he wasn't into that at all. Well, so I say he's a good shot. I don't mean he's a good shot with a rifle. There's a big difference. Anybody who's a hunter knows there's a big difference between handling, you know, a handgun. You know, you're going to go and shoot something that's 30 feet away or 50 feet away and using a rifle. There's no comparison. You have to have a whole different set of abilities, in my opinion, at least.
Well, we can't even be certain. Just, you know, the picture of him holding the rifle has been doctored. And then when you see that, he's dead. He never got a trial, so we don't have to worry about any defense evidence coming up to interfere with the official
eyeline. What we do have is a bronze plaque. We have 2 of them, but we have one about this. The thing's going to last for 2,000, 4,000, 6,000 years, and it says that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Officer Tippit, and we're going to bring that, excuse my language, damn thing down.
Well, I don't believe that either. Another piece of research, because I know my guns, and, you know, that makes me a bad boy, I guess. But one thing I did learn, I was looking over the shooting incident with Lee at the police station and looking at Jack Ruby, and I came across a book written by Jack Ruby's lawyer. He was dead then. He was the estate lawyer. And it was just one of them. I've never, ever seen anything like that. So I was quick to grab it. And it was chilling, what I read in there, just chilling. Because, one, he wanted to get the gun, and he did get it eventually, but only to see it. They wouldn't let him have it. The best he could do was go to the law firm after a long contentious issues in the courts and actually see it, touch it, and hold it. And when he got it, he got the Smith & Wesson, not the Colt. And it was broken. And then you could just read, even though he's dead, they killed him about a week later. Well, he died of some cause, but I believe they finished him off because he figured it out, that the Smith & Wesson was broken. And that means that didn't shoot anybody. So that means Lee's gun didn't shoot Officers Tippett. It was broken.
I can tell you, I saw what Lee's gun was, a long nose. This thing was a snub nose. Lee wouldn't have even had a snub nose. They didn't have any kind of... The number one weapon of choice for off-duty Dallas police officers was the snub nose 38. So here we have a record of Mitt McDonald walking in one of his interviews. He let it slip. He said, I approached Oswald with my gun drawn. Lee Oswald has his hands in the air. We have all these police officers saying, Lee, reach for his gun. Actually, Lee had said, this is it, or whatever, something like that. But what we do know is that we know that Mick McDonald reached down, and he said so himself, toward his belt line. In my opinion, he was trying to place the gun, and Lee probably thought he was going to shoot him with it. So he fought desperately, put two guys in the hospital, and then when he was, it's just dreadful. I think we have a break now again.
Yes, indeed. Don't fight with a Marine. You're not going to win. And we'll see you on the other side of the break with Judith Berry Baker. And we're off. Power Hour Nation, we're taking you to Dallas. We're reliving some of the most important history in the world, never mind the United States, because it's not that often a president is assassinated, although for me I always look at it like the old murder mysteries or something. They had a thing, the butler did it. In my opinion, any time a president is murdered, the first person to look at is the vice president because of the key bono. He or she will be the only person to benefit from a crime of this nature. And I don't believe they should get the keys to the store. I think they should just be a caretaker president for 90 days until there's another election and someone else is put in power. Because, as history seems to point out, it doesn't seem we can trust too many of them. President McKinley didn't want to appoint one for like two and a half years, and then when he did, he got shot. It was probably very astute before not to have one, especially one like Mr. Johnson, who seemed to be a real devilish rogue. But if you go over the pictures of the of Lee, you will see that there is a Smith & Wesson in his hand, not the Colt, that had a hammer shroud. You can clearly see the hammer, and you can see this pistol has wooden grips, square wooden grips, and a front sight that looks like a Smith. It's round. It's not the tapered one of the Colt that they allege is the actual murder weapon. He's holding Lee's gun. They got them mixed up, or the one they claimed was Lee's gun. That's a very, very important point, because the Colt had the hammer shroud. The reason it has that is so you can shoot it in your pocket. So I believe personally that Ruby was a patsy, too, that he was set up for this. Because what idiot in his right mind is going to go on television in the police station and murder someone, knowing full well that's the end of your life as you know it?
Fortunately, I did know and met Jack Ruby, and David Ferry knew him very well. And there's no doubt that Ruby had no other choice but to do what he did. And he was too involved with Lee. They wanted to make sure he was shut up too, so they made sure that he had to do what they wanted. Or he had a sister who would suffer. He would have two dogs that he loved that would suffer, and I could go on and on. And Dave told me they were to cut off every protruding part of his body. That's easier to believe after what we saw, what happened recently to, journalists.
Yes.
That's right. If you were living in overseas, you would have heard more about the recording where he was actually dismembered while he was still alive, and they don't want to talk about it like that. That's why it's really awful and hideous, and they've tried to keep that under wraps. But this is what we heard before it was suppressed. We get a lot more news overseas. But anyway, the problem, of course, of this gun, first of all, Lee had owned such a gun, and the fact that it didn't work is that's just all too easy. I mean, they could do whatever they want with that gun planted on him, and nobody's going to get hurt, right? Nobody's going to get hurt. Poor Tippett. All right. But anyway, I'm just saying, I was just talking to the group here about the death of David Ferry. I don't think we have much time left. How much time do we have left?
Oh, we've got a half an hour and a bit, so I wanted to ask you about David Ferry, so it's a good place to go.
All right. I've talked to others about this. I'm going to backtrack a little, but I think everybody here would like to know, because we have pretty good proof now that David Ferry was murdered, and I can explain why. Just went to New Orleans a few weeks ago, and it was filmed. It was also filmed in July, because this stuff is important. They're tearing down the house that was surveilling. You used to have Look Magazine or Life Magazine. You know, they were up there, and they were watching David Ferry ever since his name got in the paper. And Dave, you know, he called Garris's office. He said, "My name is in the paper." He says, "I'm a dead man." 5 days later, he was dead of natural causes. Yeah, right. In the great shape he was in. I mean, this man was in pretty good shape. He passed his annual inspection, you know, as a pilot and all that and so on. He flipped me. I mean, I said, "Hey, I'm pretty good in martial arts." And he went, and I was on my flat on my back. And he was a strong man. And he had high blood pressure. He had some thyroid problems and so on. But he did have a bleed. But a lot of pilots have minor bleeds in their heads because they go up. At that time, they go up and they have they're in private planes and there's not enough pressure in the anybody who's been a pilot, they know that you can get headaches and stuff like that. What I'm trying to say is they tried to say he died from an aneurysm that burst in his brain for no good reason. You know, it just did and he had high blood pressure, so that did it. And all of a sudden, it did it right after George Lardner interviewed him. George Lardner, Washington Post. Oh, my goodness, what do we have there? We've got the Washington Post. A new reporter, he's fresh behind the ears. They send him to New Orleans. He's not just an ordinary man. This man, his family lived right in the same town I did in small, teeny tiny Niles, Michigan. His uncle was Ring Lardner. Ring Lardner was a communist or was accused of being so by the McCarthy era people. And he was blackballed. He was a famous guy. He was a fitness guy who, sports writer.
Welcome back, Our Nation. Our guest host, George Freund, Judith Ferry Baker with us, and we're proceeding to Dallas at Mach 2 so that we can catch up with our conversation because it's going to go by fast and furious. But I'll just ask two questions of Ferry that maybe you can answer for me. One is that he was a master hypnotist. I think we should know a little
absolutely,
bit about that.
Absolutely.
Another,
well,
let me get to the second question.
In my arm
I'll ask them both, and if you could let me, then you can run with the ball. Another one, in your meetings with him, didn't he also say that he was going to assassinate President Kennedy as well as Fidel Castro in perhaps some sort of conversation you had with him?
David Ferry?
Yeah, didn't he mention something like that?
You've got to be really careful because, of course, they dirtied up David Ferry as much as they could so that you wouldn't want to have anything to do with him. And, of course, they had to kill him as soon as his name got in the paper. David never at any time was against Kennedy. And the only time that you hear him talking like that is when he's talking to his anti-Castro friends. And he wants to get information from them, so he pretends he hates Kennedy and all that, but it wasn't true. If he said, like it says in my book, me and Lee, he said, what if I said, hail to the chief? Because that's exactly what David told me. He said, what if I said, hail to the chief, to all my anti-Castro friends? You think you're going to tell me anything about their plans about how they hate Kennedy and who's against Kennedy? How's he going to find out? He does it by saying that he doesn't like Kennedy and that he's all for them and he's against Kennedy's policies so that he can understand and interpret what they might be doing next, because that was a hotbed there of all kinds of plots against the president, even by the anti-Castro Cubans.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to get straight so that people know from your observations, because you were there,
This man absolutely thought the world of Kennedy. Remember, now, there was a period of time in there that when everybody believed him, and he believed it himself that he hated Kennedy. And this happened right after the Bay of Pigs. He had trained some pilots and all that, and they didn't get air support. at least one of his friends that he had a homosexual relationship with was murdered, and he was hated Kennedy. He stood up at a group of veterans. They were retired military officers. It was their first meeting. They had him as their keynote speaker. That's how important David Ferry was to all these military officers. He gets up there and says Kennedy ought to be shot. Oh, they made him get off the stage. And what happens later? As soon as the meeting's over, here come these couple generals and some colonels and some so on and so forth. They come and say, you know what? We feel the same way. You want to join us? And for 2 weeks, David Ferry was ferreting back and forth information among these people. So, yeah, they thought he hated Kennedy. And he never pulled that back publicly. But as a matter of fact, he changed his mind because then he found out Kennedy went and fired Cavill. Kennedy went and fired, you've got all these, yes, everybody. Dulles, he's going down the line, and then he realizes he's getting rid of everybody that caused the trouble at the Bay of Pigs, and it wasn't Kennedy's fault. And then you remember, David Ferry was a Catholic, just like Kennedy. He was a Irishman, just like Kennedy. And he had voted for Kennedy, he told me so. So he changed his mind completely, but he's not going to tell all these people because he's gotten in on the inside track. And this is how Lee Oswald was able to get information that helped save Kennedy's life in Chicago. So there you go. Because Dave Ferry had all kinds of mafia connections. That's why my book is called David Ferry Mafia Pilot. He was actually a mafia pilot. So it's very complex, but there's no doubt that David Ferry secretly was on Kennedy's side, and that's how we got information to try to help save Kennedy's life.
And what about the hypnosis abilities he had?
The hypnosis abilities he had were absolutely 100% fantastic. I saw him with the flick of his finger put two kids, they were Cuban teenage kids, like he said, they would walk right off a cliff for him. There's no doubt about it. He had total control of them. And they wanted it. They loved it. They loved him. They loved what he was doing and trusted him 100%. Now, he tried to put me under and Lee under. This was ridiculous. Because you can't put everybody under. No, that's ridiculous. It's not possible. And my sister and I actually had trained ourselves to resist hypnosis. We had an acrobatic act and we had pain. You have pain when you're in, working as an acrobat. It hurts. When you do those splits, it's not always that fun. So we had tried hypnosis and all kinds of things, and I found out I was completely resistant to it. And so was Lee Oswald. So he tried with us, and Dave thought he had actually hypnotized me, but I put on a... So here he comes with this big hat pin, and his thing was about 4 inches long, and he rammed it, bam, right in my arm. I went, nothing, you know, because I did not want to give up. I was pretending that I was hypnotized. Finally, I pulled it out of my arm and said, you didn't even steroid my arm, you know. I didn't want to get tetanus, you know. And so, he just went, yeah.
And Dr. Sherman, she died just before she was supposed to appear or in time with the Warren Commission that, very
on
bizarre.
On July 23rd, 1964, the Warren Commission came for unsolicited, that is, they had come earlier to New Orleans, but they had their own list, their own special list. Now they said, okay, anybody want to come forward? So what do we have? We have a huge murder on the front page of one of the main witnesses. How many people do you think came forward? Okay, who came forward? The people who came forward worked for Marcello and so on, and you just didn't get they just made sure it was a farce. Because Dr. Mary Sherman's on the front page, and all of us who knew her, I wasn't knew about that. All I knew is that Dave and Mary, Dr. Mary, both had to be dead because they didn't contact me again. So I knew they were dead. And we loved each other. We really cared about each other a lot.
Well, something, in the book that is disturbing is that the wounds on her were very egregious. They talked about her arm being burned off and her thorax.
Well,
what did they do to her?
Well, here's what we can tell, and that's forensic. I thank God I've had forensic training, I have a Bachelor of Science degree in anthropology, not a Bachelor of Arts, because of all the science I did in forensics and so on. Like, I can put the skull together, you know, and show you what the face looked like and so on. And in this case, Dr. Mary Sherman, all the wounds show that she was stabbed after she was dead. All right. The crime was made to look like what a serial killer actually was doing in Houston and other places at the time, but that was in Texas, all right? And so they tried to make it look like a serial killer, I think. I know Edward hasn't gone that far into it, but I have gone a little further because I was so interested, you know? But what I'm trying to say is we're looking at the body. Her hair is not even singed, and yet her arm has been incinerated. It is missing. There's only a piece of bone sticking out from her right arm. It is gone. This is so horrendous. They didn't even put that in the newspapers. All they did is said, you know, they found her. But everybody, it went like wildfire. People knew anyway, you know, because it's hard for a policeman to see that and not tell anybody, you know. So her arm is missing, and they're trying to, she was, had folded clothes stacked on top of her and behind, under her, and the mattress was set on fire. But what's interesting is the incineration we're talking about, there is a line on her body. Half of her body, all the way up to her headline and all that, her face is contorted. You can tell it was electrocution that killed her because of the twisted features of her mouth. This is why they cover people's heads when they electrocute them, because their face becomes grotesquely distorted. It's really disgusting and sickening to look at. And she has that kind of horrible expression on her face. This is a person I care about. Then this woman, but yet at the belt line, the rest of her body, there isn't even, it's still white as flesh and everything. So, you know, the electric shock there, the plastic belt, you see, didn't go on further down. So we know this was an electrocution of some massive amount of energy. And, of course, we believe it was the linear particle accelerator that was being used at that time, working with the cancer project that we had. We also have a lot of circumstantial evidence in the case as well. But it's really, you're ruining my dinner.
Indeed. Well, these are facts that have to come out to people to understand the level of ruthlessness that we're dealing with.
They'll go to any length, and they'll do any kind of mutilation to the body or anything to frighten others and to make sure they're quiet. And it worked, because the day that she's on the front page is July 21st, 1964, the very same day the Warren Commission comes to get testimonies in New Orleans. And nobody is going to talk who really knew what was really going on. Dean Andrews, he's the one that comes up. He's the big fat guy, you know, says, oh, cock-a-doodle-doo on your head, you know. He's a lawyer for Marcello, and he gets up there and fights.
Welcome back to We're going fast and furious in Dallas with Judy Berry Baker. And another question I'd like to ask, because we had another, you know, suspicious death. This one was of a Warren Commission member, Bill Boggs. And he was driven to the airport to take off by none other than Bill Clinton. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. But he was the proponent, or not a proponent, of the single bullet theory, which is, you know, pretty much, you know, the crux of the
He was against that. Boggs was not the... We have the actual proponent, you know, was somebody else. It wasn't Boggs. Boggs was against the Warren Commission's final conclusions. He especially disliked Hoover and thought he was responsible for a lot and was trying to get Hoover out of power. And it's Hoover who got the information about where that crashed plane was. And Hoover kept it in his desk when, after Hoover died, they found, there it is, the location of where these people were. They were waving their hands, somebody come rescue us, and they didn't. They let Boggs die up there in Alaska. Okay, and Hoover knew. He's a murderer.
Oh, indeed. He's not on my short list for great great people in history. Actually, I came across the book J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and the Secrets, that is just the reader's digest of everything dirty.
Yeah, okay. Really, Hoover is on my short list of being one of the, well, everybody knew, too. I mean, in New Orleans, I say, with the homosexual community there, and the reason that we were involved with homosexuals is because they could go and blackmail so many people, because they say had an incident at that time with another male, and he was in Congress or something. They had him wrapped around their little finger. I mean, you know. So here, Lee is associating with David Ferry, who is a homosexual, and what do we find out? They're calling Hoover Mrs. Hoover. They knew it way back then. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, Mrs. Hoover wore her dresses, you know, too high and so on. Yeah.
That's the juxtaposition that we face, is here you have a man who's, you know, just basically organized crime central, and he's personified in the media as being, you know, the superhero of law enforcement, the nation's top peace officer, you know, Mr. Moral Majority's emblem, and in reality, we have got, you know, the devil from the deep blue sea just running law enforcement.
The uncle was a homosexual, and he says, look, his private parts there were shaved. Oh, he's such an expert. The other, no. But anyway, private parts were shaved, but they have to always shave down there anyway when they're going to operate. So when they had him on the table there in Dallas, they're going to shave that area to get all the offending hair out of the way because they've got to do catheters or whatever. So, I mean, he lied, but they don't want anybody to know that Lee Oswald had a girlfriend, so they really pushed the homosexual stuff.
Indeed.
No.
Because at that time, it wouldn't be the slightest bit popular. Back with Tippit, you know, I've read articles that, you know, Tippit was murdered for his body because he bore a striking resemblance to John.
I'm glad you brought this up because I talked to the people here just prior to, and here you've brought it up. That's very interesting. All right, here's the fact. Tippit was the most... at least for a while. He wasn't beloved when he was alive, but boy, was he beloved when he's dead. Even at his autopsy, the police were there guarding everything. The police were there for his open casket wake. The police, over 1,000 police went by and looked at his open casket before he was buried. We have a film about it. You can see it on the film. At Bethesda and at Walter Reed, but especially at Bethesda, it was a teaching hospital where they taught people how to do autopsies, and you had all kinds of soldiers who donated their bodies. They didn't have to go and risk taking somebody all the way from Dallas, Texas, all the way up there to do something with their body. When this man was shot in the forehead, what kind of brain is that going to be that shows a shot from the front? So, you know, just use common sense. It didn't happen, but it causes us to have waste our time, get all worn out with all these crazy different theories out there.
Indeed. But when Robert, his brother, saw the body, didn't he say that this isn't my brother?
No, that's not what he said. We have a picture of John Pick, looked at a picture of Lee Oswald when he was at the Bronx Zoo and said, it doesn't look like my brother, but the angle of the sun is different. And Lee, if he'd been in a fight, his nose was swollen. That's all it was. He's a kid, and he was in a lot of fights, and I just saw his nose was swollen. I'm glad I had forensics because you can understand what you're looking at. What you're looking at, Lee Oswald, when he died of a hemorrhage. When they opened up for the autopsy, all this blood came pouring out. When somebody is working up their muscles, okay, they will pump the blood into their muscles, and they'll have a nice and heavy muscles that even a muscular guy won't look that muscular unless he pumps his blood in. When all your blood is drained out of your face, drained out of your body, all your muscles go flat. So he looks so different. But what happened when they actually supposed to have given him injected fluids back into him. It didn't look like him. You know, they didn't put enough fluid back in him. They didn't love him enough, of course. And when they brought his body out, it was in terrible condition, showing they never gave him enough fluid, you know, to make the cadaver not rot away, for example. And then you have the fact that they don't sew the lips together. They didn't pump the lips up either. Their lips were very thin. But it was Lee. You have the same musculature. You have the same skull formation and everything. It is him. But it just didn't look like him because all the blood was drained out of him. The difference between a cadaver with blood in it and one without is enormous. Absolutely. You can't even tell sometimes if they're the same person. You have to look at the dental roots to see if they're the same person. It was Lee. It's just, it was hard. Poor Marina had to open his eye to see it was him. Lee had his special eyes. They, under artificial light, they look kind of brown or hazel out in the open. If the, he could reflect the blue of, into the, of the sky into his eyes would look blue. His eyes basically looked under ordinary sort of gray, gray-blue. He called his eyes gray. Other people call it hazel. And he had a dark rim around the outside edge of his pupil, of his iris. So Marina opened his eye to look at his eye, and then she could see that it was him, just because his eyes were special.
Indeed. We're close to running out of time, but one quick question of some information that's rather important, too, is I came across information about the limousine having a hole in the windscreen.
Yep. And that, we have way too many witnesses say that hole was an entry hole from the front. And we could go into a lot of details. Here's something interesting about the limousine that people need to know. There used to be a window between the drivers and where the Kennedy and Jackie would be. They removed that window. By removing that window, they removed an opportunity. They made it more easy for a bullet to go through. And indeed, go through the windshield. If it did, it lodged in the throat and went down, probably down into the lungs or somewhere else like that. That cannot have been an exit bullet from the back. It's just ridiculous. Of course,
okay,
you know, Ford,
we're running out of time, Judith, so I have to thank you for coming out. And none dare
God
call it conspiracy.
All.
So bless you and have a good time down there.
Okay, thank you very much. God bless you all. And read my book, Me and Lee. Read David Sherry, Moffitt Pilot.